Take it away, Hugh Gordon.
Yeah, this is an interview with Rick Draband in Detroit by Hugh Gordon, and today is March the 4th, 2004. Rick, let's start with your basics, where you were born and raised and educated.
Well, except for the brief stint when I knew you in the mid-70s, living and working in Washington, D.C., I've lived and worked in southeastern Michigan all my life.
Okay.
I was born in the Detroit area and lived in Detroit and near-in suburbs for virtually all of my life. And it's only now, within the last 8 years, that we ventured as far away as 70 miles from the center city.
Okay.
With a retirement home on the lake.
That's Brooklyn.
That's right. It's Brooklyn,
Michigan. That's a resort community.
I'm sorry?
Is that a resort community?
Well, actually, it's called the Irish Hills, and it's considered a resort community because in a 81-square-mile area, there's 52 lakes, and most of the properties in this area have been weekend and summer cottages.
Okay.
But it's only within the last couple of decades that larger homes have been kind of dotting the landscape, and mine's one of them.
Well, you're a Detroit native.
Yes, sir.
Tell me about your schooling.
Well, my educational process took me from Trenton High School, which is a suburb of Detroit, to the University of Michigan.
Okay.
Spent 2 years on the Ann Arbor campus of the University of Michigan, and then went to the Dearborn campus of the University of Michigan to take advantage of a co-op program in the business school that they were running at the time.
Okay.
And what that gave me the opportunity to do was become introduced to Ford Motor Company as a co-op student.
Oh, yeah.
And the way the arrangement worked was you worked one semester and you and went to school one semester, and you did that through your undergraduate
right.
work. That began my employment with Ford Motor.
What'd you do?
Lasted about 5 years.
What did you do? You work on the assembly line?
Well, as a matter of fact, I started out in the scheduling kind of a job in the production control department, which is eventually become controlled or been called materials management now.
Right.
But certainly got involved in all of the prefabrication inventories and worked exclusively for Ford in the glass plant of the glass and chemical division. And then prior to my graduation, because I got married and had the need for more income, I transitioned to become one of the youngest foremen they ever had in that division. And I was a first line foreman on the midnight shift, going to school during the day. And that's how I finished both my education and what I was still working at Ford Motor Company when I left there.
All right. You were still going to school while you were a foreman?
That's right.
On the co-op? Doing the co-op?
Well, it was the tail end of the co-op program, and I transitioned to full-time work instead of the semester switch-off.
What was your degree?
It ended up to be a bachelor's of business administration.
Okay. All right. Let's go back to high school. Was your school integrated?
No. There
was
were
all white.
No people of color. It was all
okay.
White.
Okay. And the neighborhood you lived in, was that integrated or all white?
It was all white.
Okay. When did you graduate from Michigan University?
Graduated in February of
1966. Okay. Now, what about your classes at blacks in that?
Yes, but not many.
Not many. Okay. Well, see, that's important to me.
And interestingly, most of the blacks that were in my classes at the University of Michigan in the early 60s were athletes on scholarship.
Okay. All right. Well, that's more segregated than I imagined. When did you first experience working or being with black mechanics in an integrated situation after you finish school?
I became exposed to the challenges of the civil rights movement during school. And in fact, while I was an undergraduate in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan, my resident advisor was an African American from Seattle working on his graduate work, who became a pretty important influence in my educational process and my thinking. I was responding to your earlier question that talked about who was in my classes, but in fact there were several substantial influences that were African-American.
Well, your counselor affected your thinking now in what way?
Well, as you know, back in the early 60s when I was on campus was the start of the civil rights movement.
Right.
And there were always inquiries and discussions surrounding that, and Hanley, which was his name, certainly because of his race, was dramatically more immersed in the study of it, and would provide, upon request, more in-depth articles and writings and information than one could get from the more generic media.
Yeah. And when did the riots start?
Well, in Detroit, they really didn't, in effect, until the summer of 67.
Yes.
However, nationwide, some of the earlier ones were as early as 64 and 65.
Well, in 67, I believe, was the year that we had riots across the country. I've heard them think in 300 cities.
Could well have been.
How did that affect you? What were you doing in 68?
Well,
67.
In 1967, I believe it was,
right.
It was 66. 66. I went from Ford to Chrysler Corporation. Got an opportunity to get involved in a management training program. Fairly select program for Chrysler Corporation.
Okay.
Only had some 25 individuals throughout the company in it at any one time.
Okay.
And it was a two-year program that demanded graduate work part-time in the evening.
Okay.
Locally at the university of your choice, being three locally that you could commute to, and I picked Wayne State University.
You say they were about 20 in that?
20 to 25,
okay.
Never more than 25.
Any blacks included?
Yeah. There was probably, out of the 25, it might have been the representative 10%. And interestingly, one of my best friends at the time was one in the program. And as a consequence, I had an opportunity to spend some in-depth discussion about a variety of issues with a person of color, the same way I did in the dormitories, which continued to help evolve my views.
I want to contrast their thoughts with, blacks in the South. I imagine they're strongly and concerned about the discrimination and the lack of opportunities.
Well, one of the biggest single messages I remember from that time, whether it was Hanley Norman from Seattle or Larry Gibbons from Detroit, or several other people I interacted with at the time, it was pretty much the same message, and that is that the segregationist policies that were described as Southern also very much alive in the North. However, they weren't a matter of law, but facto kinds of efforts, and that in fact there really wasn't, to borrow a quote, a nickel's worth of difference between the situation in the North and the South, other than in the South there were both laws and political verbalization of the situation.
Yeah.
In other words, the message they were trying to get across to me was, don't think we got anything solved up here.
Okay. All right. Now, when did you get, what was your job when I knew you?
When I went to Chrysler for the first 2 years in the management training program, it was a rotational program where every 3 months I worked at a different location for a different arena and so on, and that was supposed to give me the broad brush set of both contact, which turned out to be more valuable than the actual knowledge I received, as well as broad brush knowledge. What I did after the training program, which would now take me into 1967-68 time frame. And I might point out that when the riots occurred in Detroit in 67, I was on assignment to the national negotiations between the UAW and Chrysler Corporation.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, I sat at the bargaining table and took minutes, and that was my job, to transcribe minutes from the negotiation sessions. And in fact, many times sat right across the table from Walter Ruther and Doug Frazier, some of the names that now are historical icons of the UAW. Coming out of that program, I went to work as a personnel representative at the plant level.
All right, which plant was this?
And I was at the Highland Park Machining Plant, which was a fascinating place to work because there were exactly three minority foremen, and all the rest were white, and there was one black general foreman, all the rest were white.
Okay.
The workforce in the skilled trades was 90% white, 10% black, and in the hourly ranks it was 90% black and 10% white.
Okay.
And so it was a fascinating experience. Because, in fact, in the year following the riot, I was working on the off shift, a split between the afternoon and midnight shift, and the entire workforce, virtually, was African American and young males, and who were working for relatively insensitive and judgmental middle-aged white foreman.
Okay, were those skilled jobs?
No. Well, skilled from the standpoint of it took some training and break-in period, and there were job aides on site, but basically they were entry-level and assembly and factory-type jobs.
Okay.
The only skilled jobs were what I described as the skilled trades, and even that, because of past practices, was dominated by white people, even in a plant. So in other words, if an assembly line with a totally black staff went down, it would be white skilled tradespeople that would come in and work on the thing to get it back up.
Okay.
And all of that had to do with policies of
Let's get to when you got into the training.
That would have been in 1969.
Okay.
A guy that I had worked for during the rotational program picked up a job in the Chrysler Institute, working in terms of trying to figure out how to make the Hire First program work within Chrysler Corporation. And at that time, he bought a number of people that I had worked for marveled, I guess, at the depth of understanding that I seemed to have that no other white people had availed themselves of what it was those people wanted.
Okay.
If you can remember those quotes.
Yeah.
and after I finished my Master's of Business Administration under the management training program that I just described,
okay,
I started working on a second master's at Wayne State University in urban planning. And that was a cross-dimensional program that dealt with every discipline, finance, political science, economics, and so on, from an urban development point of view. And some remarkable instructors.
This is at Wayne State?
That's at Wayne State University, which is still just a phenomenally great.
Do you know that
the
Wayne State University had the first vocational guidance seminar in 1964, where educators of black people and business people got together to...
I'm not surprised. They've always been a forerunner as it related to cutting across the... urban political line.
You talked about the Hire First program. That's the NAB,
right?
Program.
And then, like I said, when I went to work for this gentleman, recruited me into it from my plant job. I really was kind of an aide-de-camp or a jack of all trades early on in the structuring of the program. I worked directly for him in terms of doing a variety of organizational needs assessments. Figuring out with him how we ought to structure the program, and basically trying to figure out a way how to amalgamate the program into the corporate structure.
You're talking about the training program.
Yeah. What happened was that at that time, General Motors and Ford were trying to figure out how to integrate workforces in some of their plants, and many times that required transportation. Transportation, because many of their plants were in suburban and cornfield kinds of environments.
Okay.
In Chrysler's case, that was not the situation. At one time in the late 60s, something like 28 of 30 of our plants, both assembly as well as feeder plants, were in urban environments, Newark, New Jersey, and mostly in the city of Detroit. And so consequently, the only transportation that was necessary was the local public transportation for the workforce.
Yep.
However, there had been a number of long-held practices that weren't as inclusionary as they probably should have been. And the corporate fathers at that time decided that they would get involved with the NAB jobs program in a formal way.
Okay.
And in effect start a Hire First program,
okay,
that would recruit the unemployed disadvantaged, but then do something with them over the first several days, weeks of their employment.
Okay.
That would then be able to bring them into the mainstream less obtrusively.
Okay. That program involved pledging to hire certain numbers and then a follow-up headcounting of what happened?
Not really.
Well,
pledge numbers typically were voluntary.
Yes, I mean.
And in this case, it was contractual.
Oh.
In other words,
we got
money to do this from the NAB jobs program.
Okay, that's the jobs program, job opportunities in the business sector.
Right.
So Chrysler was involved and contracted, and then, of course, that fed the people into the plant. Was there pre-hire training in that?
For the first 2 weeks.
Were you involved in that?
Well, that was part of the responsibility of this department that I got recruited into. So I was involved in both the design of the program as well as the organization of the staff to do it, as well as the delivery.
Well,
from a staff standpoint.
I understand. Was it commonly called the NAB program or the jobs program? Talking among yourselves.
Embarrassingly, it was called for a number of years until we were finally able to change the vernacular.
Okay.
The hardcore program.
Okay, I got you. Yeah, we had that.
It stigmatized the program. It was really unfortunate. But even in the boardrooms, when they approved the contract, they couldn't called it the hardcore program.
Well, that is universal. There's some articles, Nature articles, that called it the hardcore program. I think there was a quote somewhere that Lyndon Johnson was called the program. He let slip and said the unemployables were what you business people to help me to solve this national problem. This training then was tailored to these people.
That's right.
Because of their deficiencies in education and work ethic.
And that was an interesting point too, Hugh, because it was tailored to this group of hires, and they were defined throughout the corporation as people you normally would not hire.
Exactly.
And yet what we found was that the same people, if they walked in a different door, could get hired when, in fact, they needed people to work on the lines and they were recruited. And the point there being that most of the early stages of this program were based on the prejudices of the white program design team. And so one of the things that we did early on was try to become a little bit more formal with the actual needs assessment and determining what the qualifications of the entry-level worker was that was supposedly rejected at the plant gate versus the entry qualifications of the worker that were accepted at the plant gate. And guess what?
No difference.
You're damn right. There was not much difference at all.
Well, it was
but there was always somebody from a university level making a buck on some program design that wanted to have you buy a bunch of alarm clocks and teach the hardcore how to get up in the morning.
Well, I think what you're saying that prejudice is in the mind of the beholder, and they may be looking at these people differently than they would if they weren't classified as hardcore.
And what I'm also saying is we ended up gearing our program to include the kinds of training that should have been provided everybody that went to work. And one of the reasons why the hires at the plant gate ran through a turnstile of turnover, whereas our hires tended to stay a lot longer, is we included a lot of things in the program, like the reasons for the rules and regulations in the plant, the genesis of those rules and regulations. We started dealing with questions of hands-on training so that, in fact, somebody would come onto the floor after their 2 weeks of training with some idea of the tools, the nomenclature, the kinds of parts they'd be working on, the kinds of assembly processes they'd be working on. And then, even if they went to work for a bigoted, let's wash them out before their 90 days mentality foreman, they'd succeed because they knew more about the job than the people working next to them. And what we tried to do at that point was figure out a way to mainstream the entire program. But what we ended up proving, probably, was that the regular policies of entry-level training in the company were deficient and should have included a lot of the things that we were getting for our so-called hardcore.
It sounds to me like that this was the train that was tailored to the hardcore turned out to be upgrading the basic entry-level training for all employees.
A lot of the more enlightened plant managements picked up aspects of it and did it. But the biggest single problem was, is because we had government funding, we were given a little bit of a grace period by which to do it. The powers of the P&L statement continued to provide too little training for the people coming in the door because they wanted them actually productive 12 and a half minutes after they punched the clock.
Sure. Yep. How did these hardcore, those people, fare? Turnover.
what you're going to get from me here is strictly anecdotal because I don't have a lot of data, but I can tell you what I remember.
Okay.
I remember it basically depending on the plant-by-plant percentages. I think we were a few percentage points better in terms of retention than the off-the-street hires in every plant. And if a plant had a reputation for washing them out, our people, while still being better possibly by a few percentage points than the off-the-street hires, were still not as good a percentage of retention as they should have been. And then there were individual kinds of situations where what little bit we were able to do for them before they came in to the production line was still stigmatized because of the program that they came from, and that tended to have an ameliorating effect. But generally speaking, turnover was horrendous in the auto industry and continued to be horrendous in the auto industry. And to this day is still higher than it should be. Even though most of the turnover problem kinds of jobs have over the last three decades been farmed out to suppliers. So now it's the tier one and tier two suppliers that have the turnover, and the big three is able to assembly just the vehicles and use their robotics, and they have a lot less turnover.
What about advancement of the hardcore into higher rated jobs, skill jobs? What was the experience there? Didn't you expect people to move up after they came in and functioned at an entry level, low skill job?
Well, as a matter of fact, the approach that we took and basically were allowed to take is after someone would receive UAW seniority, the different system kind of got involved in their matriculation. And except for a very brief and haphazard upgrading attempt, also by contract, we really did not get involved in a lot of effort of tracking some of the people that we brought
in. Did you have a lot of grievances from...
Could you hold on just a moment?
Yeah.
We did a tracking, as I recall, of the grievances, and, you know, as I recall, and again, you're dealing with a guy, 30-year-old memory on anecdotal discussions,
okay,
as I recall it, there was no appreciable difference in the amount of grievances for our enrollees versus off-the-street hires. However,
in other words,
what
black.
We did find in looking at that, and I remember this very clearly, was we discovered they didn't even think about this at the corporation until we did this agreement study, and they were amazed that they tried to ignore it. With plant by plant, the differences were amazing, and what in effect we ended up doing inadvertently was critiquing their own labor relations staff.
Really? Did you have plants in the South?
I'm trying to remember. I think we only had a couple Huntsville spaces. There might have been at both plants in Plano, Texas, but we didn't have these programs in those plants.
Yeah.
We kept these programs they were all in Detroit, except for Belvedere, Indianapolis, Newark, New Jersey. And I think that's it.
Did you have resistance from the white manager? Like the problem we're having in this plant is we had to hire all those hardcore people.
Yes. And in some plants, to be fair though, there were more progressive thinking managements that worked with us and tried to make it as good a situation as possible.
But you did have attitudinal problems.
No question about it.
Okay. Was there any special way you dealt with that, or was that sort of
well, I what we did initially, or what was done initially before I was recruited into the program, was the corporate hierarchy kind of just kind of came down with a fiat saying, this is what we're going to do in your plant.
Right.
And that was terribly resistant across the board. What we started doing, and I can still remember doing this on a round robin touring process with myself and the guy that brought me into the program, making the rounds and having meetings with the plant managers and the plant personnel managers, is on a plant-by-plant basis, trying to do a more specific, tailored orientation for their people and what would work and what wouldn't work.
Okay.
And as you might imagine, receptivity was all across the board. But we did eventually get into a first-line supervisor orientation so that they would know what a kind of program that their recruits were coming through.
I think I mentioned to you that General Motors had this new workforce program, and we had to build a people program in Lockheed, which was a form of race relations sensitivity. It was presented to the supervisors as a job to support production. But the fact of the matter is, we were sensitizing our supervisors to dealing with blacks and cultures since they were not familiar with. Well. Did you have any of that?
Well, another division of Chrysler Institute that did its periodic supervisory training updates built some of that into their curriculums in that same time frame. But as you won't be surprised, having spent a life in the corporation, they never talked to us and we never talked to them. We'd hear that there was some stuff in the curriculum that was in their rotating training program for the first-line foreman that applied to our stuff, but here we were, probably the most qualified in metropolitan Detroit to talk about the kind of sensitivities that would be necessary, but they'd buy a canned program from somewhere else and bring in the midnight shift foreman to watch the movie and then turn on the lights and wake everybody up and send them back to work, which is pretty much how in-service training went on at the time.
Let me concentrate on one point here. Our history is about affirmative action, which is, of course, business. It's not anybody but business. At these changing times that we were all going through in the 60s and 70s, I'm looking for the affirmative things that companies did make this change in hiring work. And all I'm looking for here is not detailed things, but an overview of that. It appears to me, let me put it back this way, that a number of the things that you're talking about were just follow-up things to make sure that the hiring program and the training program would work, and dealing with the reluctance of management of management and how to deal with people that represented a different culture.
I think that, yes, that's true, and it's primarily because that was my exposure.
Okay.
And, you know, the fact of the matter is that organizations, especially in the auto industry, tend to be relatively compartmentalized, and so consequently, there may well have been a lot of other things going on that I was never exposed to. Because I certainly, at that stage, while I was in my, at that time, late 20s, didn't get too much of a chance to be exposed to the big picture, nor was the person that I worked with.
Okay, all right. Well, let's talk about your transition to the National Lines of Business. How did that happen?
Well, I think, as I best recall it, and you know, some of it happened planned, and some of it happened accidental. The accidental part was that I became increasingly knowledgeable of the various kinds of things that NAB was doing at the local level, because we coordinated some of our recruitment for our training programs through the local NAB offices and their efforts.
Okay.
In terms of qualifying our recruits.
Okay, the NAB Metro.
And as a consequence, I got to know some of the people at the local level. They were amazed that at one point in my evolution in these programs, I was not aware of the fact that, A, there was a national NAB organization, nor was I aware that, B, Lynn Townsend, my boss's 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 boss, was the national chairman. I'm schlepping around in the trenches trying to make a program work under contract guidelines that I'm aware of, and the titular head in Washington, D.C. of all of these programs is in my organization. In any event, that ignorance was washed away quickly, but not with any amount of detail. However, someone in the national organization discovered that Chrysler had program, they thought, at the time, and suggested that some representatives of the National NAB office come out and visit. And a couple of people from the National NAB office, to include one of the NAB founders, a guy named Bob Wilson, and his personnel director, a guy named Don Edwards,
right,
and a couple of other people, came into Detroit for some kind of meetings with Ford and GM and Chrysler.
Okay.
And we were able to schedule them into our training center. And Bob Wilson talked about the Chrysler program as being exemplary until the day he died. It made a very, very important impression on him in terms of the set-aside school that we had that operated those programs at the time. That gave me some exposure to the National NAB office in coordinating the setup of these programs. Some of that exposure got me onto a couple of committees as a in-the-trenches content expert for program design as it related to the upgrader programs at the time. And as I got involved in a couple of committees dealing with that, by the time the mid-70s, someone at the NAB office, and I'm not really sure if it was Bill Ross or Tom Rink or Bob Maxey or Fred Wetzel or all of them, inquired about the possibility of my coming to work as a loan executive. And they decided, and again I'm not sure who in that hierarchy that I was talking to, names through there at the time, decided to make a name request for me to Chrysler Corporation.
Sure.
And but informally contacted me to find out whether or not I'd be interested in doing it if they asked. In other words, they didn't want to go through the trouble of making the request
That's
and have me turn it down.
The way the system works, okay.
And so it was totally informal.
When you
the only condition was that when I finally got asked, I had to act surprised.
What was your role with NAB?
When I went to Washington, I was recruited to fill a slot called the Vice President of Disadvantaged and Support Programs.
Okay.
And at that time, the way the organization structure worked is each of the programs that NAB had a White House mandate to run, veterans, ex-offenders, and disadvantaged, all had a vice president on loan, typically.
Yes, I understand.
Heading up the programs at the national level, reporting to the executive vice president of operations, who was on loan from the then sponsoring company. And that was my role. I was in charge of the most generic and largest of the program.
Yes, the disadvantage. The economically disadvantaged.
That's correct.
Okay, did you travel much, or did you do most of your work in Washington?
No, I traveled a remarkable amount.
Visiting companies, individual companies?
No. It would have to be defined to you as the rubber chicken circuit. Basically, what was happening at the time, and you may have recalled this from some of your Atlanta days, is to take advantage of time and numbers. What the local organizations, sponsoring organizations, and motivating organizations, be they chambers of commerce or be they whoever, would do is try to assemble a group of business leaders to, in effect, be explained to and sold the NAB mission.
Yep.
And
we did that.
My task was to be kind of like the articulate expert from out of town. To be introduced at the podium and to basically talk about why they ought to and how they can and how grateful we are to the local business organizations to put this luncheon or seminar or conference together.
Well, that, as I see it, was one of the key affirmative things help indoctrinate the local businessmen who are part of the NAB hiring and training group to enlighten them as to how important their role was and help them deal with it.
I agree that that was a major part of it, and quite frankly, I was surprised that so much of my NAB life as it did. I was under the impression that they wanted me to come to Washington to work on an expansion and a promulgation of contract programs, which I was an advocate of because that was my background. And in fact, what I discovered was that the preponderance of the NAB effort across the country was volunteer, as opposed to contractual, and that a lot of locales wouldn't even touch contractual relationships, and a lot of companies wouldn't even touch them. They viewed them as being problematic, red tape ridden, difficult, and so on. So basically, in so many situations that I found under my job responsibility, was totally different than what I thought I was being recruited for, and I basically had to adjust.
Well,
I became a proponent of the voluntary hire program.
Well, that is in large part what history is going to cover, which represents a gap in American history, and that is how much commitment there was for business and how in the jobs program, and that business. As business people would in their companies, they define the problem, they assign people to go deal with it, and that's pretty much what I see what you were doing as a part of this orientation and motivation of local businessmen to deal within their companies with what is national community problems. They were hiring people they normally wouldn't hire. The NAB program was totally different from, you mentioned this earlier, hit with it a little bit more, and that is that in the normal hiring process, this is my function, you hire the best qualified people, and when you're called into court for disparate effect on people that are covered by law, your defense is that it's best qualified. Come in if they were qualified. But President Johnson, in effect, said, I want you folks to hire the people that you don't hire and train them.
Yeah.
And that took a lot of effort, and you were, as I see it, involved in keeping the business informed and motivated to support the program.
One of the offshoots that came out of all of this, I think, was in a number of cases, some scales were lifted from private businesses' eyes that maybe the qualifications that they were applying might well be hiring tomorrow's turnover statistic. Because in too many cases, the qualifications went beyond the qualifications of the job that they were recruiting for. And so many times, especially in the Rust Belt industries, and certainly the auto industry's entry-level jobs are an example of that, what would happen is that relatively highfalutin academic, many times, requirements were being applied, and all somebody might be looking for walking in that door that meets those requirements is employment that'll take them over a hump until they can move on.
Well, there were some lawsuits that dealt with that. The test of the DuPont company on the use of the Wonderlic test as a screening device, and also high school diplomas as a job requirement. And I think these are things that you're talking
exactly.
about. Exactly. It broke down. I hear you. Chrysler was dealing at that with those things voluntarily.
Well, and what they were doing, interestingly enough, is what they had was kind of a moving target of hiring criteria. In other words, I was just saying that in my experience, part of the thing that caused Chrysler some legal headaches was the hiring policies were administered at the local level, and much of the interpretation of what they would and would not accept, who they would and would not screen out, was based on the job market availability at the time. And so consequently, 1 month, it might be real possible that somebody with a GED would be rejected. The next month, they'd be accepted. Another month, someone without a high school diploma might get in, simply because there was a production manager screaming, I need 15 people to run this line tomorrow morning. Where are they? And that became a moving target that didn't really lend to the objectivity. I think everybody was probably applying their best, frequently prejudicial guess of what the qualifications ought to be.
Did you get into legal problem? Do you recall Chrysler being sued? Charges of discrimination for
you? No, we knew that they were going on, and that kind of stuff was almost never sued on an individual basis, but there were hearings relating to the local job service. People that were let go inappropriately that filed claims and so on. But there may have been some of our trainees that ultimately found their way into that kind of situation, but none that I remember, and certainly none that I was ever involved in.
Well, what I'm trying to determine here is the degree to which all of this effort to support the NAB program, support hardcore hiring and training, how much of it was voluntary and how much of it was compulsory?
Well, you're talking to somebody who's dealing with the compulsory end, because we did most of our NAB jobs involvement in a contractual way.
Well, that's still voluntary.
And so consequently, I wasn't involved in...
Well, what I'm saying is that by court order or contract compliance...
I see what you're saying.
What you're talking about is definitely voluntary.
Even if it's a contractual, it's voluntary.
No question about it.
Yeah.
OJT contracts are voluntary determinations of management. You decided you wanted to go that route.
Yeah. Well, in my entire career with Chrysler, which ended in 1980, not once did I ever hear of a hiring mandate that
okay.
came down via
okay.
the courts.
Let's talk a little bit about the Watergate caper. You see the correspondence there.
Yes.
The group that we had, and Vic recalls that we stayed there at least 2 days. And
that's my recollection too.
And I don't know that we totally authored the paper, the letter to John Condon, but we put it together.
I know I didn't, because it's too articulately written.
Well, I'm sure it was polished and everything, but that we're credited with that, as you can see from McDonald's letters, that we that was the genesis of the thing, and it worked.
And as I reread it this morning, it's a pretty impressive document for its time. I certainly am impressed with it, and I'm delighted to have been a part of it, even though I don't remember much of it.
Well, it was my determination as to who was going to work with us, and I knew that I couldn't do it alone, and I got the people that are best suited. I looked at you. He's a large industry training and hiring and experience that,
well, if you remember, that was the first time I met you, and so consequently, I think that it was a combination of credentials and
yeah.
recommendation by some people on the NAB national staff.
Well, I'm sure
that
I
had
mean,
me included in that, but I was delighted to be part of it.
Well.
And I do remember that we basically wanted to. I mean, we came in with a desire to bring more private sector voice to the process at the planning level. And if you'll remember, one of the big hues and cries at the time, and I don't mean to use hue, one of the big discussions at the time was the fact that there were some ivory tower thinkers developing some of these programs and thoughts that didn't include enough business input, and the question was, how do we get the business? And I think our argument in those Watergate sessions was that it has to come from the grassroots level. See, because once you have business organizations at the national level, be they the Conference Board or be they the National Association of Manufacturers or even the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the business views are already if not compromised, at least generalized by the time they're reported. That doesn't mean those aren't important organizations, but with the NAB Metro setup, we had local potential for that. And that was where the PSIP thought came from, as I recall, so potently that when you're doing this stuff, do it at the local level.
Well, much of that doing it at the local level involved the OJT package that the government put together, which was onerous to business. And as it turned out, even with all the money that was set aside for the private industry councils, so many of the local NAB metros and later the PIC, got people into jobs without contract. The majority of them were non-contractual. Now, big companies like Lockheed and Chrysler had no problem with the contracts, as I experienced it. The big companies that, but when you get into the area of private sector, where it's small-sized companies, but mostly bits, they didn't touch it with a 10-foot pole.
So, well, there were some large companies that wouldn't either. Ford wouldn't, GM wouldn't.
Well, that's true. I didn't mean to say that, but I'm saying that of the money that was spent, there were certain companies that maybe for the need, for the financial need, that they would accept a contract.
Right.
That was a very common thing. Yeah, that's good money. We'll get that. We'll hire these people. We can get the money. But we looked at it Lockheed differently. We knew that this was an important program to hire people that we normally wouldn't hire. And so we engaged in contracts.
See, and at Chrysler, it even went one step further. We recognized it, and I should say, the chief architect of some of this involvement was my boss's boss, the guy who was the director of Chrysler Institute at the time. His name was Wayne Grimm, and he retired, in the late 70s, mid-70s. So he's been gone from Chrysler, shortly after he architected this effort. But to his credit, it not only was an opportunity to gain some compensation for the efforts dealing with a particular group of hires. He, being an academician from his background, also viewed it as an opportunity to get resources to write the literature for entry-level training across the country. And that was one of the things that, in hindsight, I'm amazed at, because, it was a time when he couldn't get corporate resources to do some of that kind of thing. But with a NAB jobs contract, it was able to be tucked under that umbrella. And that was another motivation for Chrysler, even though the corporation at large didn't know what Wayne was doing. But we were writing the literature every day, and certain orientation components, I'm sure, are still used.
The rationale for being involved in the NAB program is that varies greatly. And talking to Dick Preby, I was surprised. NAB was a unique arrangement there. They had this consortium called Action Now, which was supported by business. And Dick was the director of that. And he had a sizable staff. What happened, according to Dick, was that these companies would contract for OJT money, would turn right around and donate this money to Action Now, a nonprofit corporation. And that's how his salary was paid. So it was, I think.
Yeah, local interpretations across the country, I'm sure.
Well, that's the, I think one of the chief aims of where I was coming from with the Watergate case. To let business ingenuity come into this thing and get them into the ball game where we've not been. We're not in the federal employment and training ball game. And our nation was spending literally billions of dollars every year without private sector participation. And so whatever it took to get us in there, once the legislation was passed, handle uniquely in every community in a way that fit that community. I think that's, I'm seeing Chrysler did it one way, and Louisville did it another way, and Atlanta did it another way, and they all worked because the private sector was in the ballgame.
And one of the things that was possible under CETA for the first time was local variations, whereas prior to CETA, under MDTA, there was a national set of guidelines, a national set of rules that were administered nationally through their regional offices. I guess when it comes right down to it, the more I think about all of this conversation and the voluntary involvement of business and the increased inclusion of business in programs of this type, I think they all fall under one or both of two categories. If you think about it, I think one is enlightened self-interest, and certainly that would be the Chrysler situation, or influence by some other force, be it a organization. In other words, to get businesses involved on a voluntary basis in programs of this type, they are influenced by some other force, and or they just recognize it as enlightened self-interest. But those are the two reasons that they would get involved in
local. I like that Fred Wenzel's way of looking at this. That secondary force that you talked about was a sense of growing corporate social responsibility. And when they could do that as a group, like the Merit Employment Association in Atlanta, we got the, key companies, Coca-Cola and Southern Bell and Trust Company Bank and so forth, with the leaders in the community. And once we got organized, then other companies joined. Join what they saw as a something that's good for not only our companies but the community.
But when it bow waves out, it's because of the influence of Coca-Cola, or in St. Louis, the influence of Anheuser-Busch or somebody, or in New York, the influence of Watson at IBM.
Yeah.
And I guess what I'm saying is that, I'll agree that, maybe there's somebody that got enlightened, or somebody that had lunch with a Black Panther, or somebody had a wife that was Christian and concerned about what's going on in the city and influenced them. But once that kernel is developed, it's the influence peddling by somebody that makes a call, says, let's have a meeting, let's talk about this. In other words, you don't have a whole metropolitan area of businesses gets socially enlightened at one time.
Let me read you a quote that I keep here, and it's from a man named Robert Schuller in Surrey, B.C., wherever that is. This is in the literature, so it's just a very short quote. The power of one. Great movements were not started by groups. There had to be leadership.
I agree. Was it Austin in Atlanta with Coke? Or was it somebody else? But if you trace it back, somebody started it.
Oh, I did.
Okay, well, there you go. And you had the ear of somebody that could peddle the influence to the other
but
corporate
But the same
head.
Thing happened at Paul Austin.
White House meeting, I'm not sure if we'll be able to determine that it was a benevolent movement and the time has come on the part of executives, or whether it was enlightened self-interest. I mean, Lyndon Johnson might have told those 15 people, your cities are burning down and you're not doing anything, and corporate America needs to step up and do something.
Well, there's no question.
You know what I'm saying?
I've got a tape of that. I do have Leo Beebe's tape of the whole thing.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. It's really interesting. Of course, Johnson, being the super powerful politician that he was, he had a way of getting cooperation. And they tell a great story, that we had this story published in one of the working magazines called Duddington. I said, I've gotten this story directly from Paul Austin, who was in the meeting. You remember Don, don't you?
Sure.
Okay. He and another guy came down to Atlanta and interviewed Paul. Paul Austin, and this little story was published in a working magazine, and the story goes like this. Johnson had the 15 men there, and he made this presentation himself. I don't know, he had a flip chart or something, and the National Alliance of Businessmen, and at the end of the had him for lunch or dinner, I'm not sure what, and then they went into this room in the White House, and he did this, and at the end of that, this man, one of the moguls of America, unnamed, spoke up. He said, "Mr. President, I believe we can go along with this." And Johnson said, "Mr. So-and-so, when you bit into my steak, you went along with this." That's a great story. That was public. Well, that's what you were talking about. Yeah. I mean, here's a leader that made a very compelling case, but he did it on the basis of the interest of the country. In fact, in that comments, he said, the government. See, he'd had, this is his Great Society program was very ineffective. That was to serve all and solve all the unemployment problems. So he said, "We have spent billions and billions of dollars. We're not getting there, and we need your help, the private sector's help." So not every company really just jumped into this thing. They had a hard time turning down the president of the United States, but they had to think about it, and I think that they did carry back a sense of corporate social responsibility. We're going to do this. It's not only for a company, but all the communities where we operate. And, of course, the riots were very prevalent, so we knew that was bad. There were forces, but the ultimate thing is that historically, is the sense of corporate responsibility, social responsibility that exists today. That was the genesis of the when John stepped forward. That's where what I'm getting from that, my own personal experience on this thing.
Well, I hope my little hour here has been helpful.
Yes, it has. It has. Just dealing one last thing, dealing with what I'm saying, though. Did you sense any of that in the mandates that came down from the Chrysler executive?
I'd have to say no.
You don't know. No.
And you know.
How did it come down then?
Well, by the time I got involved in it, it was the gospel. Was interpreted by a guy named Wayne Grimm, who was the director of the Institute. And quite frankly, my bias was that a contractual program was the best and only way to go. And in fact, I can remember in my youthful naivete in the late 60s and early 70s, criticizing Ford and General Motors for being gutless.
Gutless,
not willing to take on the contracts, which were the only way that their fictitious hiring numbers could be defended. I mean, you know, I think now that I look back on it, I was both a bit of a demagogue and a bit of a naive young man, but I can remember saying those kinds of things. So I guess my answer to your question, Hugh, is that until I went to Washington to work on a part-time basis, I had no idea that there really were some potent and appropriate and defensible voluntary programs in NAB's purview across the country.
Well, see, you were looking at it from the standpoint of Chrysler.
That's right. And more importantly, from the standpoint of my escalation in the Chrysler system. I mean, very definitely personal, career-oriented stuff. And so consequently, you know, you got to remember, when I met you, you were in your early 50s and a pretty sage fellow.
when you met me, I was in my late 20s and pretty much a crazy motherfucker.
You know, what you referred to there was certainly true. The criticism of NAB, and it had a lot of critics, the same as Plans for Progress did, was that they couldn't verify the statistics because there were so many accredited hires were voluntary and not contractual. With the contractual hires, you could track it, but the rest you couldn't. And that was true because I think only 25% of the money was spent, and most of the hires came as I had. I had 3,200 pledging companies in the 8 southern states, and very few of them had OJT contracts. We turned in some impressive numbers, and if you just took those numbers and said, oh, half of them is people that represent people that would have been hired anyway, it still was a massive program. So that's sort of where I'm coming from on this thing, is there's room for both philosophies.
Right. Well, I guess my point was is that, you know, until I got into Washington, I didn't realize that.
You thought it was all done contractually.
Well, and if it was worth anything.
It was worth anything, okay.
Yeah, I mean, that was my bias.
Uh-huh.
And see, the thing is that by the time I came back to Chrysler, I was on my way out of Chrysler. What happened is, while I was still in Washington, they started the situation of the Lee Iacocca movement. And once I got back, you know, I was only back for a year and a half, and the company was in pretty good turmoil, and Iacocca was coming in, relieving Ricardo, and the writing was on the wall for prior Chrysler executives. I mean, you know, the people coming in from Ford with Iacocca didn't think we could find our way to the washroom. And so by 1980, I had made plans to get out. By August of 1980, I was gone.
Rick, I want to thank you. This has been very, very interesting, and I'm sure that a number of points you made in there fit right into your history.
Well, you have my permission to edit it anywhere from totally out to including anything.
Yeah, well, what we didn't do with the transcript, though, is just select things. We don't, your transcript is not printed in it, so see how your experiences fit into the picture that we're working on. And it's good because we have totally different experiences. You know, Atlanta is different from Louisville and different from Chicago and different from Detroit. So put it all together.
My only qualifier in any of it is the same one I talked to you about from Florida, and I repeated today, and that is that everything you got from me is my opinion, my anecdote. And I really sit here with no data to back it up.
Yeah,
and so consequently, I don't feel the least little bit vulnerable if you quote this crazy young man.
Okay. I think it'll happen.
And keep me posted on the publication
okay,
thing
well,
on
we'll
it.
Do
I'd
that.
Love to see it. I'd like to see the finished work. You've got my address and phone number.
All right. Got all that. It's going to be a while.
Well,
it's a slow process.
And with God willing, we'll all have a while.
Okay.
Stay healthy, Hugh.
Take care. Thanks again.
Thank you.